This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker today was the senior senator from the state of Illinois, Richard Durbin. Dick is in his 21st year, serving the citizens of Illinois. Currently, he's the assistant Democratic leader among Senate Democrats. The topic that he talked about was one that will really grab your attention. It dealt with violence and trauma in the city of Chicago and elsewhere. So far this year, 2017, there have been 2,435 people shot in Chicago, 454 have been killed, and 176 of those who were shot were children, and 27 of those have died. He talked about the complex causes of the carnage, the need to stop the flow of illegal guns, how gun dealers should need state licenses to operate in the state of Illinois, a need to close the gaps in the FBI background checks of people with guns. And then he said, Congress will not act. The NRA has the president and Congress cowered, so don't expect any action from Washington. He then went on to talk about trauma and the cost of trauma. And after he talked about various cases, he said, we must change the formula that biology becomes biography. He said, many people are looking for help. We need to identify and support groups that can help deal with trauma. There must be a better way of using federal funds than are currently being used in cities like Chicago. Bottom line, Senator Durbin said, it costs more to ignore trauma than to treat it. We must temper hurt with hope.
Jay, thanks for the nice introduction. Ed Mazur, thank you for the many kindnesses you've shown to me and my family. This is my first city club without Paul Green, and I miss him. And I know we all do. A fantastic person and a great resource, and always had a little jab for every speaker with a tough question. I looked forward to it, and I'm sure you will, in his tradition, make sure I face the music afterwards, too. Donna Fenton there is one of my faves, and she and I went to, I remember saying, would you go to a Cubs game with me? Because she wears Cubs earrings, and she said, sure, and we went to opening day a few years ago. And naturally, opening day at Wrigley Field, you never know what to expect. Well, it was a snowstorm. And we ended up in a box, and we were there with Billy Williams, and she got her picture taken. And I was sitting there watching the game, and I looked around, and darned if she wasn't waiting on everybody in the box. And I said, Donna, you're a guest. You don't have to work here today. But she's a wonderful lady. And I'm glad to count her as a friend. And as I told the folks at my table, with Loretta's permission, she's my other girlfriend. So, Donna, glad that you're here. Topic I want to discuss with you this morning, or this afternoon, is serious. And I hope that each and every one of you will listen and share some thoughts, questions on anything that follows. But it relates to the reality of the world that we live in. Do you remember what you did last weekend? Some people do, and many people are scratching their heads trying to remember. 63 people will remember it because it was a weekend that they went to an emergency room with a gunshot in Chicago. Some will escape with a scar. Some will face surgeries and maybe brain damage. And some will face paralysis. For 8 Chicagoans last weekend, it was their last weekend on Earth. It was the deadliest weekend in this city since the longer 4th of July weekend a few weeks ago. So far this year, 2,435 people have been shot in Chicago. 454 have been killed. That's down from last year, Chicago's deadliest year in 20 years, when more than 4,300 people were shot in that year and 789 killed. But it's still horrifically high. No one is spared from this violence, not even children. Last year, more than 300 children in Chicago were shot. 36 died. So far this year, 176 children have been shot, and 27 have died. This past June was the deadliest month for children in Chicago in more than 15 years, one child being killed on average every other day. Since 2000, gun violence in this city has taken the lives of more than 1,000 children. In his frustration and anger on Monday morning, Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson said, this weekend of killing represents, quote, the culture of Chicago. He added, we cannot arrest our way out of this crisis when the criminal justice system is not a deterrent. The causes of this carnage are complex. Many people are working from every conceivable angle to end it. Faith leaders, many represented today, I'll acknowledge a few as we go through the remarks. Bereaved parents, community leaders, business, education, public health communities, public officials, and law enforcement. Many of you in this room. Sometimes it must feel like you're pushing a boulder up a hill, but you are saving lives. Thank you for what you do. Today I want to talk about three approaches to this that I believe can help. First, we need to stop the flow of illegal guns into our city's neighborhoods. Last year and the year before that, the Chicago Police Department recovered more illegal guns than their counterparts in New York and Los Angeles combined. About 60% of the crime guns recovered in Chicago come from out of state, Indiana, the leading source. We can debate about what exactly our founding fathers meant with the Second Amendment to the Constitution, but we know this. When they wrote the words, a well-regulated militia, they weren't talking about nine-year-olds armed with 9mm semi-automatic handguns. Yet, those are the types of high-powered and easily trafficked firearms that are fueling the bloodshed in Chicago. As Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson once said, the Constitution is not a suicide pact. I agree. We can respect the Constitution and do more to keep dangerous guns out of the hands of criminals and children. Here are a few of the things. And I salute the state legislators who are here today. Gun dealers in Illinois should have to obtain state licenses, follow common sense safety measures to keep people who shouldn't possess guns from acquiring them through straw purchasing. I support the efforts in Springfield and salute those who are here who do support it as well to require reasonable safety measures. But no state, including Illinois, can stop the illegal flow of guns alone. Congress should toughen our weak federal laws to stop straw purchases and illegal gun trafficking. I've introduced a bipartisan bill with a stalwart and brave lady named Susan Collins of Maine and Senator Pat Leahy, a Democrat. Congress should also close the glaring gaps in FBI background checks that make it easy for convicted felons, terrorists, people with mental instability, and others to get handguns and other weapons. But let me be honest with you, Congress will not act. The National Gun Lobby has our Congress and our President cowered, and not even the most heinous slaughter of children in a classroom in Connecticut or the carnage on our streets is going to change that shameful political reality in Washington. As Superintendent Johnson reminded us, we can't just police our way out of this epidemic of violence. If we're going to ask young men to put down their guns, we need to offer them a chance at a better life, and that has to include a job. I'm glad to see Father Mike Flager here. As you know, he's spoken to this group before, and you certainly know him by reputation. He is my friend. You know that he's a pastor at St. Sabina's in Auburn Gresham. About a year and a half ago, I got a message that he left for me. Father Flager wanted to tell me about a young man, 26 years old, a former gang member. This young man and Father Flager had an interesting history. Several years ago, the man had put out a hit on Father Flager for the trouble he was causing the gangs in his neighborhood. Sounds like Mike Flager, doesn't it? One day, that young man came to Father Flager and asked, "Will you help me? I want out. I don't want to live this way." Father Flager helped him. He enrolled him in a GED course, and he helped him get a job delivering pizza. A year later, January 2016, the young man was driving down the street with his grandmother when two gang members with an old beef walked up and shot him and his grandmother in the head. She survived, but he didn't. St. Sabina's was packed with gang members for that young man's funeral. Father Flager said the funeral mass. He asked the mourners this question: how many of you young brothers would like to give up this life? How many of you want to go to school and get a job? 150 men came up to the altar. Father Flager said, "I could find jobs for three or four of them. What about the rest? How can we help them?" Until we can answer that question, we won't end the cycle of killing, retaliation, and more killing in Chicago. Listen to the numbers that tell the story. In a recent report, 39% of young black and brown men in Chicago 39% between the ages of 20 and 24 are not working and not in school. Remember that number, 39%. Nationwide, it's 25% of young African-American and Latino men nationwide out of work, out of school. White men, 8%. Then the researchers looked at where the homicides occur in Chicago. They found five neighborhoods: Austin, Englewood, Back of the Yards, West Englewood, Grand Crossing. Those five neighborhoods account for about 8% of our city's population, but 32% of the murders. In those five neighborhoods, the jobless rates among young black and brown men range from 79 to 91%. Does anyone doubt there's a connection between lack of jobs and violence? The mayor's One Summer Chicago program brought together government organizations, community groups, businesses, and others to provide summer jobs to 31,000 young people. I've seen them. They're transformative. For many of these young people, it's the first time in their lives they've ever had the responsibility of work. Many other organizations are also working, bringing jobs to the neighborhoods. If you're part of those efforts, thank you. A week after he took office, President Trump tweeted that he would, quote, send in the feds, close quote, if Chicago doesn't fix the carnage. I say, Mr. President, if you want to use the power of the federal government to help end violence in Chicago, we welcome your help. Send us federal dollars to revive our economically abandoned neighborhoods. Send us help for job training and apprenticeship programs. Help us close outrageous tax loopholes that pay companies to ship jobs overseas, and instead, let's have a tax code that rewards American companies, creating jobs for Americans with decent pay and benefits. Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio and I have joined in introducing a bill to do just that. Jan Schakowsky is a sponsor in the House. I've also introduced a bill to expand tax credits for employers who hire at-risk youth, and another bill to make it easier for local governments and community organizations to apply directly for federal funds to support summer and year-round youth employment programs. I'm willing to meet with this president anytime, anywhere, if he wants to work to help create jobs and a more positive environment in this city. Now, the last proposal I want to give you, I think, is critically important and is often overlooked. If we are ever going to stop the bloodshed, we must learn to recognize and heal the deep wounds that violence and traumatic loss inflict on the minds of those exposed to it, especially the developing brains of children. A year ago, I went to the Cook County Juvenile Detention Center and spent the better part of a day meeting with those who were teenagers, waiting for trial for having shot people, and talking to those who worked with them. Those who are waiting for trial don't come and go. They're there for long periods of time. There's a high school, there's GEMS, there's programs, and counseling. And I said to the counselors at the Cook County Juvenile Detention Center, what do you find when you sit down with these largely men, young men? What's going on here? We find everything, Senator. We find bipolar. We find depression. We find it all. But in 92% of those who are waiting trial and come through this Cook County Juvenile Detention Center, we find the same thing. They have either been victims of violent trauma or exposed to violent trauma. Now, that is not a coincidence, my friends. It's a reality. Many have lost parents to addictions, incarceration, or death. They've grown up in poverty and chaos. They've lost friends, classmates, and family members to violence. Now, when I visit classrooms in the city and other places, I say, how many of you here have seen someone killed or had a close friend or family member murdered? More than half the hands shoot up in the classroom. Let me ask you, how many of you have seen someone you know or love murdered? If you have, you'll never forget it. How many of you worry every minute of every day that a stray bullet could come out of nowhere and end your life or the life of someone you love? And now ask yourself, what if you were 8 years old and just answered yes to both of those questions? Now, I went over to the Hines VA hospital, and I was invited in for a counseling session for returning veterans. These returning veterans came back with PTSD, and they let me sit in on one of their sessions. And it was transformative to see them walk through the door, close the door on a Friday afternoon, and many of them break down in tears in front of me. They had gone through battle, and they were battling the wounds that they brought home with them. Think about that for a minute. These are members, former members of our military, who were carefully screened before they were inducted. They were trained extensively by professionals. They were sent into combat with careful supervision and support, and yet they come home in desperate need for support and counseling to heal their psychological wounds. How can we possibly believe that children who grow up surrounded by the daily threat of violence and loss can cope on their own or just outgrow these traumatic experiences? 20 years of research, the advent of MRIs and other brain scanning technology have given us definitive proof that exposure to violence and trauma dramatically affects kids. Experiencing repeated trauma leaves emotional scars that can last a lifetime, but literally change a child's brain chemistry. It can force children into a constant fight-or-flight mode. This can result in what can lead to emotional difficulties, developmental delays, and a variety of chronic health conditions, all factors that perpetuate the cycle of violence and poverty. We know, for example, that children who experience violence and traumatic loss are more likely to suffer serious asthma, panic, and flashback. They are more likely to suffer from depression and anxiety. They are also more likely to have trouble focusing and learning in school. A 2012 study of children in a Chicago neighborhood found that children who took reading or vocabulary tests shortly after a murder in the neighborhood performed dramatically worse, as though they had lost several years of academic progress compared with the students who were tested before the murder. Our lives are intertwined. A single bullet can ripple through a family and a community, shattering the fragile sense of safety and security that many of us take for granted, and leaving in its place grief and unimaginable loss and heartbreak. We now know that adults who experience trauma and violence as children are more likely to suffer from heart disease, stroke, diabetes, depression, addiction, lung disease, liver disease, and many other chronic conditions. They live sicker and die younger than people who don't grow up surrounded by stress and the threat of violence. It's important to stress that not all children who are exposed to trauma and violence will develop these problems or have these mental and physical challenges. And with proper care, many children who are harmed can be healed. But for too many children in violence-scarred neighborhoods, their biography becomes their biology. Here's the reason why. It's estimated that only 25% of the children in America who need mental health care actually receive it. Black and brown children, those most likely to experience this violence, are even less likely to receive the help they need to prevent trauma-related mental and physical difficulties. To put it another way, when it comes to gun violence in Chicago, sign me up for 1,000 cops, but sign me up as well for 1,000 counselors. We need them both. Now, here's the good news. The good news is there are many people in this room and many I've met who are showing us a path forward. Dr. Colleen Sacchetti, is she here? Well, tell her I mentioned her name. Colleen has an amazing staff at the Center for Childhood Resilience at Lurie Children's Hospital, and we've sat down many times to talk about their work. She came to Washington recently to brief congressional staff on the effects of violence and toxic stress. She has taken on the daunting task of educating a senator, and she's done pretty well. She and her team at the Center for Childhood Resilience work with school districts all over our state, educating and training not just school professionals, but community health agencies, city leaders, and parents to recognize and help. A few months ago, I went over to Pilsen with her, and we went to a school there, all Hispanic kids. And they had decided to pick out of 1,200 kids, four that they could help. Four out of 1,200. So naturally, they went to those that they thought needed help the most. A mother was there to tell me the story. Hispanic lady, she told me the story that she had two little kids in the first and third grade, and that 6 months before, her husband had walked into the living room where they were all sitting, took out a gun and killed himself in front of them. As a result of that experience, these kids started going through flashbacks, night terrors, and became withdrawn in class. They had no interest in anything. Their mother called one of the teachers and the teacher suggested that both of them be part of this program. Gradually, those little children opened up and talked about their grief, their fear, and their anger. The changes were profound. I met the kids afterwards. They didn't know the circumstances, why I was there, and why I was meeting with them. Perfectly normal and happy kids who had been through that life-shattering experience. The mother said to us, when I look at what's happened to the kids, Senator, I'm going to get some counseling too. So we understand that folks are looking for help and need to find places to turn. Chicago has the knowledge and the leadership and the infrastructure to become a national leader in childhood trauma. We have an army of organizations that have made a difference. Under Mayor Emanuel and Chicago Public Health Commissioner Julie Morita, Chicago is working to become the largest trauma-informed city in America. We have a lot of people who desperately need their help. I've introduced a bill in the Senate to help make it happen. It's called the Trauma-Informed Care for Children and Families Act. My partners are Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota and Al Franken of Minnesota, and in the House, Congressman Danny Davis. Danny knows the heartbreak of gun violence personally. Last year, his 15-year-old grandson was shot and killed by two teenagers arguing over shoes and clothes. Danny's heart is in this cause, and I couldn't ask for a better partner in this effort. The need in Chicago for trauma-informed care is staggering. A 2013 study conducted in Chicago neighborhoods with the greatest levels of violence found nearly 9 out of 10 kids aged 15 to 17 had been exposed to this kind of violence. 1 in 3 had lost a close friend or family member. 1 in 5 witnessed a murder firsthand. Yet few receive any mental health services at all. This bill is going to really try to build on innovation here and other places, educate and train adults who can help these young people, frontline people, expand Medicaid coverage of trauma-informed counseling and services to more schools, enable more kids to benefit from these curricula, and provide proven, innovative in-school mental health programs. Young people are 21 times more likely to go to a school clinic than to another clinic for care, and we want to make sure we're there to help them. Our bill is also going to enlist community leaders. Jay and Joy Luster, I've met Jay in the course of my education on this subject, started a project called Calm Classrooms. Thousands of students in Chicago are taking advantage of that now. Mentors from the YMCA's Urban Warrior programs. My buddies like Wayne Gordon, Coach Wayne Gordon, sitting up here, like Mike Flager. He's been on the front lines of the battle for 42 years. Am I right, Wayne, on that? He moved into Lawndale neighborhood. Raised his family there and never left. Wayne, thank you for all you've done with Mike Flager and so many others in the faith community. One of my friends went to Jerusalem and saw a program there dealing with trauma and violence and decided to bring it right back here. And let me give a shout out to Pastor Chris Harris at Bright Star Church in Bronzeville. Chris, thank you so much. We need to have the best practices that come out of these experiences and ones we learn from around the country to make this work even better. Making these changes are not going to break the bank. What it will do is make better use of the money that we are currently spending on the violence in this city. We're going to look at every federal program that reaches kids, from Head Start to home visits to health care, and make sure it includes strategies for identifying trauma. And you know what costs more than treating trauma? Ignoring it. It's been 2 decades since the first research showed us the link. Think how much money we could have saved in health costs if we'd have followed that lead. Center for Disease Control estimates that America spends $124 billion a year on health care for adult patients who have a history of early trauma. How many lives, how many billions of dollars a year might we save by treating childhood trauma to avoid the problem before it becomes worse? We know it costs a dramatic amount of money to incarcerate these young people. Wouldn't it be better to counsel them to avoid this? We have a lot of support. Our bill is endorsed by more than 100 national Chicago area organizations, from the American Academy of Pediatrics, the National Education Association, National Council of Juvenile and Family Courts. But the most powerful endorsements for trauma-informed care may come from 2 young men from Englewood. Deshaun Hanna and Dantrell Blake are cousins. Deshaun is 20. Dantrell will turn 21 this month. Both men were shot in separate incidents, months apart in 2015. Dantrell still has a bullet in his leg. But the cousins caught a break that changed their lives. When Dantrell went back to Stroger Hospital for a follow-up, and let me thank you, Tony Preckwinkle, for Stroger Hospital and the great work that you do every single day there. Give her a round of applause. So when Dantrell went back to Stroger, he ran into a woman named Artesia Williams. Artesia was an intern then for a small nonprofit called Healing Hurt People in Chicago that works with young victims of violence. She convinced Deshaun and Trell to go back and finish high school. Then she persuaded them to get involved with Project Fire, an amazing program that uses glass blowing and therapy to heal the scars of violence and help young men chart a new course for their lives. Before they met Artesia, Deshaun and Dantrell had never thought about going to college. Today, between them, they've been accepted at 5 colleges and they're weighing their options. They are also working as peer counselors at Healing Hurt People, helping other young men who've been shot and lost friends and family members to violence. And they're helping to teach doctors and other health professionals how to recognize and heal the psychic wounds that violence inflicts. Somehow, even with all these demands, they were able to join us today. Ladies and gentlemen, a hand for Deshaun Hanna, Dantrell Blake, and their caseworker, Artesia Williams. There's a lot of hurt in this city, but there's a lot of hope, too. I hope you'll ask yourself, well, what can I do about this? What can I do to make Chicago a national leader in healing childhood trauma? Statues of Confederate leaders reflect painful racial wounds from our history, but many deep and painful racial disparities continue to wound us today. Voter suppression, lack of jobs, traumatized kids and communities. We've got to come together to heal our communities. There are things we can do. Defend voting rights, work for more jobs, be an advocate for change, including trauma-informed care for children, be a mentor for kids who need an adult to trust. If you're part of the corporate community and stepped up, thank you. If you haven't, please consider it. There are some great employers in our city who are hiring and training young men and women from violence-scarred neighborhoods. If you talk to them, they will tell you these young kids are some of the most resilient and determined workers they have. But frankly, not enough businesses are getting involved yet. We need your help. In closing, let me leave you with some words of hope from one of America's great poets, Maya Angelou. Here's what she wrote. History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, and if faced with courage, need not be lived again. Thanks for inviting me. I'll take some questions.
Thank you very much, Senator Durbin. And if anybody back there in the audience has questions, if you would just hold up your blue card, members of our staff will come by and pick them up, and we'll try to answer, the senator will try to answer, as many of the questions as we can. So thank you. I'd like to recognize my congressman, Congressman Danny Davis, who just joined us. This is like a triple header today. I've got my U.S. Senator, my Congressman, and my Alderman. Boy, unbelievable. Okay.
In reverse order of importance.
Remember, all politics are local. Okay. This is from Mike Bauer, sitting over here, City Club member. What do you think of the proposed acquisition by Sinclair Broadcasting of Tribune Media? Do you expect the acquisition to be completed?
Mike, I don't know what we'll have to say about that in terms of their acquisition. I'm familiar with Sinclair. It is a very, I'm being kind now, very conservative operation. They used to put editorial comments when they owned the Springfield, Illinois station on with regularity, and I would demand and occasionally get the opportunity for a rebuttal. It is hard for me to imagine that kind of operation taking over WGN. It just seems like such a hometown radio station that has, you know, just deep roots in Chicago history. It's hard to imagine outsiders coming in. We've seen some great dislocations already, the Tribune, Sun-Times, and other things. But I worry about it. I worry about the change of the approach at this station.
Okay, thank you. Ooh, a lot of questions. Great.
Ask them faster.
Okay, Charlie Gardner, Roosevelt University trustee. Do Democrats have a chance to recapture the Senate in 2018?
Right now it's 48 Democrats, 52 Republicans. There are 25 Democrats who are up for re-election, 9 Republicans. So the numbers are not in our favor. Out of those 25 Democrats, there are many in states that Donald Trump carried. Now, historically, except with one exception, off year elections have not been kind to a president's party, and the other party has picked up seats in the House and the Senate. And so maybe, just maybe, we may pick up some seats, but there are only two hot possibilities if you look at the nine Republican seats, and that would be Nevada and Arizona at this point. Way too early to tell how that's going to work out. I actually think that the House of Representatives, U.S. House of Representatives, may be as likely or more likely to turn. And there are lots of candidates running. In some of the Republican districts in this state, there are as many as eight different Democrats who are vying for the nomination. So there's a lot of interest that came out of the Trump election on the Democratic side at grassroots. It could be a fascinating election.
Okay, thank you, Senator. This is from Paul Singer. He's not a City Club member. Paul, remember, we'll ask your question this time. We expect you to join. He's in a liberal Democratic voter. Can President Trump shut down the federal government if Congress does not fund the wall?
I doubt that that's what's going to happen. Although he is adamant that he wants to see that big, beautiful wall built and paid for by the Mexicans some way or another, I doubt that that'll happen. And the reason I say that is I believe that we've been through this scenario a few months ago when we had to finish the budget for this fiscal year, and the Republicans now in control in the House and the Senate do not want to carry the burden of having shut down the government on their watch for any reason. So we face two critical votes right away. One of them is on the budget for the next year, which may be delayed a little bit, but even more compelling is the extension of the national debt, which if we do not do, will have the same impact of shutting down the government and our economy. I just don't think the Republican leaders or the president want that to happen on their watch.
Okay, thank you. This is from City Club member Joe Annette with Siena. Senator, where do you propose the funding will come from to support the necessary increase in mental health therapies?
Well, I can tell you first, we need to have a health care system that provides mental health services through health insurance in America. Members of the Senate and Congress where I've served have the most passion or the most effective when they're dealing with an issue that touches them personally. So there was a time when Paul Wellstone of Minnesota, with a brother who suffered from mental illness, and Pete Domenici, conservative Republican of New Mexico, had a son who suffered from mental illness, and the two of them teamed up and for years kept beating the insurance industry, saying you've got to absolutely include mental health services with other services in health insurance, and they finally won it. And we put it in the Affordable Care Act, and it makes a big difference for the vast majority of people like us, most of us in this room, who have health insurance through our employers. So you start there, but it's not enough. You've got to make sure that Medicaid, which is serving many of the lower income populations, has access to good mental health services too, which means that community clinics have to offer behavioral health. More and more are doing that, but we have to keep the funding going. We are hanging by a thread now as to what's going to happen to America's health care system. The president has said, let it sink, let it go under, and let the Democrats crawl on their knees and beg us to fix it. I hope that doesn't happen, because throughout that, the president and members of Congress will still have their health insurance, and the people across America will pay a heavy price. The good news is Lamar Alexander, Republican of Tennessee, Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington, are going to start hearings as soon as we return in a couple weeks on what to do with the health care system to strengthen it and move it forward. Incidentally, that's where we should have started 7 months ago.
Thank you very much. Shifting gears a little, this is a question from Steve Schlickman, who bills himself as a transportation consultant. He is a very good one, by the way. Senator, is there hope for broad partisanship in the Senate? And what does that mean for an infrastructure initiative?
Steve, everybody cheers a trillion-dollar infrastructure program. I mean, it's easy to explain. You look at China and what they're doing, other countries, and what we need in this state and country, and you know it better than most. The problem is, how do you fund it? How do you fund it? We haven't touched the federal gas tax in, what, 15, 18 years? It's a gas that's a tax that's imposed by the gallon. And as we drive more fuel-efficient cars and trucks, burn fewer gallons, less money comes into the Highway Trust Fund, though we still have potholes and need to build new infrastructure. So the funding mechanism is easier on my side of the aisle than it is on the other side of the aisle. But that is crucial. Let me just add one footnote. We are now moving toward more and more electric vehicles. We're going to see more of that being done. And as a consequence, fewer gallons of gas are likely to be burned. How are we then going to fund the infrastructure of this country? It really calls out for some new calculation. Instead of by the gallon, maybe it's by the mile, something that reflects the real use of the highway and reinvest back into it. I think that's the only way. But the funding is the thing that's going to stop us.
Okay, thank you. This question is from Tim Egan, committeeman of Brian Hopkins' second ward and CEO of the New Roseland Hospital. Is Trump care dead, and what can we expect to see in the coming months?
I've been in the House and the Senate for a long time, and thank you for those of you who helped me have this public career. And I've seen a lot of votes. Half a dozen of those votes fit into the category of things like war. When you're voting about whether or not you're going to go to war, if you're not lying awake rolling back and forth at night, then you're not thinking, because lives will be lost one way or the other if on that vote. So you'll always remember those votes. And there are votes you remember because that's your bill, you know, my bill to ban smoking on airplanes, my bill to do this and that and the other thing. Boy, you're on top of that and remember it for a lifetime. But then there are a handful of other votes that occur that don't fit in those categories that you'll never forget. And the vote on Trump care at 2:30 in the morning on the floor of the Senate just a few weeks ago was one of those. When I saw John McCain come through those Senate doors and walk up to the desk on the Republican side and lift his shoulder as far as he can, shattered in that plane crash and torture, and say, no, that was the end of Trump care, thanks to Collins, Murkowski, and McCain who stepped forward. But it wasn't the answer to what we do with our current health care system. I voted for the Affordable Care Act. I believe in it. I've said on the floor, and I'll say to you, if you have ever been the father of a seriously ill child and you have no health insurance, you'll never forget it as long as you live. I know I've been there. I don't want anybody else to be there. So I voted for the Affordable Care Act. We reduced the number of uninsured by 50% in Illinois and virtually nationwide. But it's not perfect. The individual marketplace premiums are way too high because the older and sicker people are signing up, and the younger, healthier ones are not. We got to fix that. Secondly, there's nothing, absolutely nothing, in the Affordable Care Act to deal with the cost of prescription drugs. It's breaking the bank. Blue Cross Blue Shield pays more out each year on prescription drugs than they do for inpatient hospital care. Go figure. It has reached the point there is no control in terms of the rise in prices. Things we have to do to make this health care system work. If Trump care is not going to pass, we've got to get something that moves forward on a bipartisan basis.
Thank you very much. Our weekly Armenian-American question from Laura Tarosian. Senator, please tell us your thoughts on initiating impeachment and what cause requires. Told you we'd have some zingers.
Impeachment is initiated in the House of Representatives. And should it occur, and I've been through one of them, I will be a member of the jury in the Senate. So it's probably best that I leave it there.
Very good. This is from Don Schellenberger with Baird & Warner. You indicated your Democratic House co-chairs. Why have you not tried to involve Republican co-chairs in the House? For example, Adam Kinzinger, Rodney Davis, Peter Roskam, or Randy Hultgren, all, of course, representatives from the state of Illinois.
I'm certainly working on the Senate side first. And as I mentioned, Senator Collins is a co-sponsor of the gun bill that I mentioned to you. I have so many bipartisan bills. Lindsey Graham and I just introduced the DREAM Act, which some of you are aware of when it comes to immigration. And I also, my co-sponsor, My co-sponsor on criminal justice reform is Chuck Grassley of Iowa. Durbin and Grassley, what's that all about? But I really try because I can count. You know, they're in a majority. I need them. They need me, maybe. But I need them and their votes. So I am not averse to having a Republican co-sponsorship and support. Danny over here will tell you that many of the issues he and I care about a lot don't excite our Republican friends as much, but we're going to keep asking, aren't we? You bet we will.
Okay. While you're gathering your thoughts, Senator, this is a compliment, so let's work this in. From Susan Hayes Gordon from Lurie Children's Hospital. Thank you for your integrity and your steadfast leadership over so many years, working to serve humanity and our nation. We need you especially now in these very difficult times. Thank you. Well, here's a question, even though we have limited time, we could probably go on for hours. This is from Kay Kamen with Sutton Place Financial. Can you add any clarity to what's going on in Washington?
So here is, I'm going to give you two numbers to give you an idea of where America is today. Roughly two-thirds of the American people have said in a poll that they're embarrassed by the president. Two-thirds of identified Republican voters say they haven't seen anything wrong yet. Listen to what I've just said and the dichotomy between the general population and the Republican primary voters. And many Republican senators, some Republican senators have said to me, you know, it's hard back home because my Republican primary voters are still very loyal to the president. And I know that that colors their decision about whether to speak out. That is part of the reality that we face. In the meantime, I would have to say this president comes to the office with virtually no government or political experience and does not have a team that reflects any experience on Capitol Hill. I might be able to remember if I think hard enough, but I can't tell you the congressional liaison for this president. I don't know the person very well. And you can't be effective in leading forward an agenda, whatever it may be, without having somebody who understands how the Hill works and to have loyal people working with you in your own party. What the president has said about Mitch McConnell makes it kind of hard for him to work with him in the future, and I understand they haven't spoken to one another for a few weeks. So that's part of the reason that things are not moving very quickly.
Okay. We have two last questions. The first one is, do you feel that the present governor of Illinois is beatable?
Regardless of how I feel, the numbers say he is. You can add us, Senator Harmon, Senator Hutchison, and others who are here. His numbers are not very good in the state at this moment. I will just say this generically. I've spent the better part of my adult life working for this state, and I am honored to do it. It's a great honor to do it. I am heartbroken of what I've seen occur in the last 2.5 years in our state. There are things that have happened around our state which will take more than a decade to repair that have happened in the last few years. The city of Carbondale, Illinois, they were blessed with this eclipse and all the tourists who came down for a few days. But Southern Illinois University Carbondale went from an enrollment of 23,000 to 16,000. They had more students transferring out of SIU Carbondale to Kentucky and Missouri and Indiana schools than they ever have in history because of the uncertainty of the state budget. The city of Carbondale, Mike Henry's the mayor, Republican businessman, nice guy who supports me in some crazy way, says to me, we've had 50 real estate closings in Carbondale as of a few months ago. We have 250 properties for sale. The biggest driver of the economy is the university. And there's doubt about whether it's going to be there for the students. I go to Black Hawk College over at Quad Cities just yesterday and talked to the fellow in charge of admissions. He says the students here would rather go to school in Iowa because they think there's more certainty that they'll be able to finish and the state will provide whatever assistance they can provide to them than here. The damage that's been done to Illinois in the last 2.5 years is self-inflicted. This is not some great devastation that came our way at the hand of God. It is something that we have been party to, and we've got to do something about. And I will just add, to think that we are even questioning whether we're going to open the schools of Illinois on time after all this is shameful. It's disgraceful. And I'll say one last thing. And this may be more political than it should be, but I'm going to say it anyway. It is beneath the dignity of a leader of the state of Illinois to pit one region of this state against another. We are one state, and we should be treated as such. My father was born in deep southern Illinois. I was born in East St. Louis and raised my son Paul and our other kids in downstate Illinois. I'm proud of it. Proud of it. Yes. But having said that, I am equally proud to represent this great city. It is a fantastic place. My wife and I spend every moment we can here to great restaurants and everything that goes with it, and they're great people. And to think that we would have to choose or pit one against another is something beneath the dignity of a public office.
Yeah. So, Senator, speaking of great restaurants, have you eaten at that State Lodge down in southern Illinois where you get that fried chicken dinner for $12.99? You can't even get that at MacArthur's on the west side. Okay, one last question. Your colleague, Mitch McConnell, any thoughts about Mitch and his relationship to the president?
Well, it's not very good. And the president's been very public about that. I think Senator McConnell made a mistake the day after we swore in the new Senate by announcing he was going to something called reconciliation. Now, that's total inside baseball for most of you. But what it basically means is he does not want to take it through the regular order of business, any issue. Anything he can, he's going to move through a reconciliation process, which basically says no committee hearings, no amendments, take it to the floor, and a simple majority passes. Well, he has 52 votes, so he doesn't want to get into the world of 60 votes. By doing that, he is really, you know, unfortunately, put us in a position in the healthcare system where we're bringing a measure before us for a vote to change the healthcare system and 1/6 of the economy of America that no one has read and no one could possibly understand. And that's why it fell apart. That's why his own three members of his own party would not support it. I hope Senator McConnell will call Senator Schumer or any of us and say, basically, all right, I'll take a flyer at the regular order business. Let's see how this works. Let's see if we can do it together. Put us on the spot. We should be doing it together. I think you've elected us as Democrats and Republicans to solve problems together. And that means that Durbin has to compromise and maybe McConnell has to compromise. But isn't that what it's all about at the end of the day, that we do the best we can and get the most done that we can? So I'm still honored to serve, although I have to tell you this last year has been very unusual in the United States Senate and likely to contend. City Club, thanks.